Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 138, but who's counting? It's Monday, November 15th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID-19 is going back up in the U.S., Ohio, and Lucas County. It's hard to say how bad this will get, but it is very likely that it will only get worse and be worse than now for the remainder of the flu/COVID-19 season. That is till March or so. So get ready for the ride. Okay, well, let's do some COVID-19 news before I have a lot of non-COVID-19 news to get to, but here we go. From ABC News, Vermont has the highest vaccination rate in the country, so why are cases surging? In Vermont, nearly 72% of residents are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, more than any other state, according to the CDC. At the same time, it has the 12th highest rate of new COVID-19 cases over the last week. Case rates in Vermont residents who are not fully vaccinated are nearly four times higher than in fully vaccinated residents, according to state data. Essex County, the least vaccinated county in the state, is reporting the highest case rate of any county in Vermont, with 1,022 cases per 100,000 people reported in 1 week. In Grand Isle County, which has the highest vaccination rate in the state, that number was 160. That's over a six-fold difference, folks, in rates. Statewide, those driving the surge include people in their 20s who are the least vaccinated among Vermont adults, as well as children aged 5 to 11 who are just now eligible to get vaccinated, Dr. Mark Levine, Vermont's health commissioner, said. Across the United States and in Vermont, we're seeing the impact of the highly contagious Delta variant, Dr. Jan Carney, Associate Dean for Public Health and Health Policy at the University of Vermont's College of Medicine, told ABC News. It's really so contagious, it seeks out pretty much every unvaccinated person. I'm going to say that again. It's really so contagious, it seeks out pretty much every unvaccinated person. The Delta surge in Vermont mirrors cases rising in the region, as northern parts of the country that were largely spared over the summer are now seeing increases during colder weather. Vermont is one of 22 states, many of them with colder temperatures, that have seen an uptick in daily cases of at least 10% or more in the last 2 weeks, according to an ABC News analysis of CDC and Health and Human Services data. Okay, and in more research showing the huge divide between vaccinated and unvaccinated folks, this from The Hill. Unvaccinated 20 times more likely to die from COVID-19 in a Texas study. A Texas government study found that unvaccinated people 20 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than the fully vaccinated throughout most of September, providing further evidence backing the vaccines. In that time period, unvaccinated individuals in their 40s were 55 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than others who were the same age and fully vaccinated. Among those aged 75 and older, the unvaccinated were 12 times more likely to die. Unvaccinated people were also 13 times more likely to contract COVID-19 than those who were fully vaccinated. Okay, well, right now in the U.S., we're vaccinating more people with third doses, so-called booster doses, than newly vaccinated people. And for a worldwide perspective on it, this from The Hill. World Health Organization chief calls booster distribution scandal as poor countries wait for doses. the head of the World Health Organization called the distribution of booster COVID-19 vaccines a, quote, scandal that must stop now, as poor countries continue to wait for initial doses. Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus slammed countries with the highest vaccine coverage at the WHO briefing for collecting extra vaccine doses and prioritizing giving their citizens third and fourth doses over getting at-risk populations in other nations vaccinated. This is a scandal that must stop now, he said. In fact, he cited data that 6 times more booster doses are administered globally than initial doses in low-income countries. I'm going to say that again. He cited data that 6 times more booster doses are administered globally than initial doses in low-income countries. It makes no sense to give boosters to healthy adults or to vaccinate children when health workers, older people, and other high-risk groups around the world are still waiting for their first dose, he added, noting that immunocompromised people are an exception. Tedros also pointed out that countries need other coronavirus precautions in addition to vaccines, saying, no country can simply vaccinate its way out of the pandemic. At least 40% of the overall global population is considered fully vaccinated, but that number includes only 2.4% in low-income countries, according to the One Campaign. Well, folks, vaccine nationalism is alive and well. This is a good case study of everybody likes to progressives and liberals like to beat up on Trump for his America First. But as far as vaccinations go, Biden's sticking with that pretty well. Granted, Trump wasn't interested in sharing very many vaccines, but boy, the inequity is massive. Okay, next up from the Hill, poll shows just how far COVID-19 misinformation has traveled. Almost 8 in 10 U.S. adults believe or are unsure of at least one false statement about COVID-19, according to a polling data published last Monday. The poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 78% of U.S. adults surveyed said they believe or were unsure of at least one of 8 false COVID-19 statements that the organization tested. That includes 38% who believe that the government is exaggerating the number of COVID-19 deaths, 17% who believe pregnant women should not get the vaccine, and 18% who believe deaths caused by the vaccine are being hidden by the government. Belief in COVID-19 misinformation is correlated with both vaccination status and partisanship, with unvaccinated adults and Republicans much more likely to believe or be unsure about false statements compared to vaccinated adults and Democrats, the analysis adds. Among unvaccinated people, 64% believed or were unsure about 4 or more of the 8 false statements. That was significantly lower among vaccinated people at 19%. Among Republicans, 46% believed or were unsure about 4 or more false statements, compared to 14% among Democrats. Yes, folks, vaccine misinformation lives on. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, one more COVID-19 story. This going to the supply issues that we've all been hearing about. This from The Hill. The World Health Organization warns of vaccine syringe shortages. The World Health Organization warned last Tuesday that there could be a shortage of vaccine syringes in 2022. World Health Organization expert Lisa Hedman said at a United Nations briefing that there have been 6.8 billion coronavirus vaccine doses administered, exceeding the total manufacturing capacity of at least 6 billion vaccine syringes, Reuters reported. If manufacturing priorities aren't changed, the world could see a shortage of 2 billion vaccine syringes in 2022. We could have a serious global shortage of immunization syringes that could in turn lead to serious problems such as slowing down immunization efforts as well as safety concerns, Hedman said. If we shift capacity from one type of syringe to another or attempt to expand capacity for specialized immunization syringes, it takes time and investment, she added. A shortage of syringes could lead to delays in routine vaccinations for children and other procedures. A shortage could also cause countries, particularly poor countries, to unsafely reuse syringes, Hedman said. Okay, well, it's time for the local COVID-19 update. Lucas County average daily cases of COVID-19 have started going up substantially. They bumped up to 156 a day on average over the last week compared to 124 the previous week. Testing positivity rates have stopped their decline and are back going up, and it looks rather quickly. We've bumped up to 12% in Lucas County from 9.8% the week before. And the state has also reversed its steady decline from 9% up to 9.8%. I'm sorry, from 9.8% to 11.4%. And this trend is not limited to Ohio. The U.S. testing positivity rate over the last week went up to 6.1% from 5%. We're back in it, folks. Flu season is here. Well, nursing home active cases in Lucas County has been holding in kind of a steady range here the last few weeks. It did go down to 34 active cases from 42 in previous weeks. That's 14 residents and 20 staff with active cases. And we did have another death in the long-term care facilities over the last week reported. So I don't know. We're in it. We'll have to see which direction that goes. That's not really clear. It's kind of going up and down. Okay, Lucas County Schools, we definitely have a trend, and this is a reversal. It was going down slowly, and it had been the decrease had been slowing down in recent weeks, but in fact, it went up slightly in Lucas County from 26 staff and 141 students to 42 staff and 142 students. So that could be an inflection point, likely in Lucas County. It's definitely went up in the state, where it went from 639 staff to 720 staff, and from 3,378 students to 3,883 students in the most recent weeks. UT, which has finally gotten to its deadline for its vaccine mandate, where there's either proof of a vaccination or being subjected to weekly testing, and it looks like they're holding about steady at around 40 identified cases per week, and their surveillance testing, which is the random testing, identified 3 people for about 0.5% of those people that were tested. That's been bouncing around at that kind of low to moderate rate there, so we'll see how that goes as we continue into flu season. Well, hospitalizations have leveled off in recent weeks in Lucas County, but they are going back up in Ohio. Deaths nationally have reversed their downward trend, and we still have over 1,100 deaths each day on average. Lucas County had 56 deaths reported in the past 2 weeks. And boy, I was hoping that that was an aberration. Death reporting's a little strange, and sometimes you get clusters and delays of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 weeks even. But it looks like over the last few weeks, we've had a lot of deaths. So this is actually as bad as it's been. It was worse than it was last winter and is comparable to the worst few weeks at the beginning of the pandemic for Lucas County. Okay, vaccinations. Those that are fully vaccinated went up 0.4% in the U.S. up to 58.8%, and they bumped up 0.3% in Ohio and Lucas County. The state is up to 52.2% of their population fully vaccinated, and Lucas County is struggling just past halfway at 50.8%. It looks like that has ticked up slightly from a big drop-off last week where there was almost no increase, but still, historically, it's low, and even at the rate that we're at now, we're not going to be that much more vaccinated even by midway or through flu season. Okay, well, I haven't reported on racial ethnic disparities in vaccination, partly because the number of new people vaccinated is so low, it's hard to change the overall rate. So these may be near final numbers for the pandemic. In Lucas County, blacks are 66% as likely to be fully vaccinated as whites. And that is worse than it is in Ohio, although Ohio's not great either. Ohio blacks are only 76% as likely to be fully vaccinated as whites in the state. Okay, well, that does it for the Lucas County update. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, we have this from The Hill. World Health Organization and CDC report high risk of measles outbreaks as pandemic disrupts vaccination. The world faces a higher risk of measles outbreaks as the pandemic has disrupted routine vaccinations, a WHO and CDC report found. While annual measles cases dropped 82% from 2019 to 2020, the report determined that routine vaccinations and surveillance of measles cases also dropped in 2020 as countries faced the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. A total of 75 countries reached more than 90% coverage for the initial measles vaccine last year, a 13% drop from 2000, and a 37% decrease from 2019. Countries need at least a 95% vaccination rate of both doses of the measles vaccine to ensure high population immunity, the World Health Organization and CDC noted. Approximately 22.3 million infants did not receive the initial measles vaccine last year, an increase of 3 million from the previous year. Increased population susceptibility and suboptimal measles surveillance portend an immediate elevated risk for measles transmissions and outbreaks, threatening the already fragile progress towards regional elimination goals, the report reads. The past two decades have seen progress, with the estimated number of measles deaths falling 94%. Since 2000, the health organizations calculated that measles vaccination prevented about 31.7 million deaths worldwide. Despite a goal to eliminate measles in 5 of the 6 World Health Organization regions by 2020, no region has reached and maintained measles elimination. It's a constant job, people. Okay, well, next up, I have an annual report that's updated every year from the Health Policy Institute of Ohio. It's their health value dashboard, where they look at the value of health that they get for the dollar and all of our efforts by state. This is a really cool thing to do. Unfortunately, Ohio, in the latest rankings, is ranked 47th out of 50 states and the District of Columbia. Yikes. Okay, the bottom line is that Ohioans are living less healthy lives and spending more on healthcare than people in most other states. In other words, we're not getting a good value. We're not getting what we pay for. Okay, so why does Ohio rank poorly? Ohio's healthcare spending is mostly on costly downstream care to treat health problems. This is largely because of lack of attention and effective action in the following areas. And it gives 3 areas: children, equity, and prevention. Okay, starting with children. Childhood adversity and trauma have long-term consequences. 42% of Ohio children have experienced trauma and adversity. Second area, equity. Ohioans with the worst outcomes face systematic disadvantages. Many Ohioans experience poor outcomes and live shorter lives because of policies, systems, and beliefs that discriminate against and unfairly limit access to resources. An example of this is there is a 29-year gap in life expectancy within Ohio counties. The highest county, Stowe County, has a life expectancy of 89.2 years. That's the high. And the low is Franklin County, where it is 60 years. Yikes, 29.2-year difference. Third area is prevention. Sparse public health workforce leads to missed opportunities for prevention. Ohioans spend a lot on downstream medical care, but investment in public health infrastructure is limited and prevention policies could be stronger. And one measure of this is public health spending per capita. So state spending on public health in the U.S. is $39 per capita. Now just think about how much that compares to like what we spend on health care. It's ridiculous. So $39 per capita is exceedingly low. But in Ohio, that's only $14 per capita on state public health spending. Okay, well, a lot of public health is local, so let's look at local public health spending. So localities in the U.S. spend on average $41 per capita on public health. In Ohio, localities spend $30 per capita, much less. Okay, well, let's dig in a little bit into these three areas for policies that can work under the domains of children, equity, and prevention. By adopting evidence-informed policies and working with private sector partners, policymakers can make Ohio a leader in health value. Below are examples of policy opportunities for the state. For children, close widening academic gaps by prioritizing federal COVID-19 relief funds for high-intensity tutoring, chronic absenteeism interventions, and school-based trauma counseling for children who have experienced adversity, disruption, and learning loss. Strengthen K-12 student wellness by allocating funds to evidence-based drug prevention, social-emotional learning, and school-based mental health. Expand access to quality early childhood care and education by increasing eligibility for Ohio's child care subsidy to at least 200% of the federal poverty line, paying child care workers more, and streamlining rapid access to child care. As some of you may note, a lot of this lines up a lot with the Build Back Better plan that Biden is proposing and they're trying to get through Congress. Okay, the second category, equity. Advance anti-racist and anti-discriminatory policies by promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion in leadership, engaging in training on racism, discrimination, and its impacts, and improving access to culturally and linguistically competent information and services. Level the playing field, starting with increasing funding and or allocating one-time federal COVID-19 relief funding to lead hazard mitigation, construction of accessible, affordable, quality housing for people with very low incomes, rental assistance initiatives, and eviction prevention. Identify gaps in outcomes and evaluate policy impacts by building systems and capacity across the public and private sectors to collect and break out data on systematically disadvantaged Ohioans, for example, on race and ethnicity, disability status, education, and income. Okay, third area in prevention, strengthen the public health workforce and data systems by ensuring that the state and local health departments have diverse and adequate staffing for epidemiology, communicable disease control, and communications, and by fully implementing the recommendations of the March 2021 Ohio Auditor of State Performance Audit. Prevent addiction and overdose deaths by dedicating a portion of future revenue from tobacco and alcohol taxes, opioid settlements, and pandemic relief towards smoking prevention, addiction treatment, recovery supports, harm reduction, and overdose reversal. Prevent chronic disease through improved access to healthy food by streamlining access to SNAP and WIC for eligible Ohioans and expanding produce perks and produce prescriptions. Okay. So why does Ohio rank poorly? In the first area of children, childhood adversity and trauma have long-term consequences. Many of Ohio's children experience early adversity and trauma, including exposure to adverse childhood experiences such as child abuse and neglect, living in poverty, and experiencing racism. Ohio ranks in the bottom half of states on measures that put children at increased risk of exposure to adversity and trauma, including adult depression, drug overdose deaths, excessive drinking, and incarceration. Burdens from child adversity and trauma carry forward across generations. Some examples of where we rank statewide, starting from birth and moving to adulthood, we rank 39th in the proportion of children that have adverse childhood experiences. We rank 36th among states in child poverty. We rank 37th in high school graduation rate. We ranked 47th on drug overdose death rate. We rank 39th on incarceration rate and 40th on the unemployment rate. If adverse childhood experiences were limited, more than $10 billion a year in healthcare spending could be saved in Ohio, and more than $319 million in lost wages could be eliminated each year in Ohio. Okay, second category about equity. Why does Ohio rank poorly? Ohioans with the worst outcomes face systemic disadvantages. Racism and other forms of discrimination drive troubling differences in outcomes across Ohio. This includes racist and discriminatory beliefs and interactions among Ohioans, and structural racism and discrimination embedded within systems and across sectors, rooted in ageism, ableism, xenophobia, homophobia, and other isms or phobias. Ohioans experiencing the worst health outcomes are also likely to be exposed to risk factors for poor health. These include trauma and adversity, toxic stress, violence and stigma, and inequitable access to resources. Our systems, policies, and beliefs unfairly favor some Ohioans over others. One in ten black children in Ohio is treated unfairly due to their race. This is 17 times higher than the rate for white children. Inequitable distribution of infrastructure, power, resources, and dollars results in obstacles to accessing education, food, transportation, housing, healthcare, and other resources for Ohio's most at-risk groups. If these inequities were eliminated, over 58,000 fewer black children and over 13,000 fewer Hispanic children would experience food insecurity. Over 36,000 Ohioans fewer lower-income households would be severely cost-burdened for housing. More than 238,000 Ohioans with less than a high school diploma would have broadband internet access. And more than 181,000 Ohioans with disabilities would not have to delay health care due to cost. Okay, in the last domain of prevention, why does Ohio rank poorly? Sparse public health workforce leads to missed opportunities for prevention. Limited investment in public health. Only three other states spend less on public health than Ohio, limiting public health workforce and ability to proactively implement comprehensive approaches to our state's greatest health challenges. Patchwork approach to community-based prevention. Ohio struggles on several outcomes that could be prevented, such as addiction and chronic disease. Stretched thin by many of the demands of the COVID-19 pandemic, public health departments now have even fewer resources to devote to these other issues. And looking at some of the greatest challenges in prevention, we have adult smoking and youth all tobacco use. And examples of missed opportunities for prevention policy. Ohio invests 10.6% of what the CDC recommends for state tobacco prevention and control. In the area of drug overdose deaths, administrative barriers to naloxone distribution and an overly complex Good Samaritan policy are missed opportunities for Ohio prevention policy. Regarding excessive drinking, a lack of sustained long-term approach to school-based alcohol and drug prevention. Regarding heart disease mortality and food insecurity, limited reach of programs to increase access to healthy food, such as fruit and vegetable incentives and school breakfast. Well, folks, there you have it. Ohio ranked 47th out of 50 on health value achieved. Yikes. I'm sorry, Ohio. We Buckeyes, we got to do better. This is also a good example, just a little mini course on social determinants of health. You notice that there didn't talk a lot specifically about health care. These are the social determinants that drive health and poor health in our state and need much, much more attention and resources. Okay, well, often there's undue focus on physical health versus mental health. So I'm going to do this story from the Mental Health America, the state of mental health in America. They put out an annual report as well. And in this report, Ohio dropped in state ranking from 11th to 25th. That's from 2018 to 2019, so actually pre-pandemic. In 2022, the key findings, some of them were in 2019, just prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, 20% of adults experienced a mental illness, equivalent to nearly 50 million Americans. Suicidal ideation continues to increase among adults in the U.S. 4.6% of adults report having serious thoughts of suicide, an increase of 664,000 people from the previous year. The national rate of suicidal ideation among adults has increased every year since 2011. This was a larger increase than seen in last year's report and is a concerning trend to see going through the COVID-19 pandemic. A growing percentage of youth in the U.S. live with major depression. 15% of youth experienced a major depressive episode in the past year, an increase of 1.25% from last year, the previous year. In the bottom ranked states, up to 19% of youth aged 12 to 17 experience major depression. Over half of adults with a mental illness do not receive treatment, totaling over 27 million adults in the U.S. who are going untreated. The percentage of adults with mental illness who report unmet need for treatment has increased every year since 2011. Over 60% of youth with major depression do not receive any mental health treatment. Rates of substance use are increasing for youth and adults even prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost 8% of U.S. adults and 4% of youth had a substance use disorder in the past year. Well, of course, Ohio's its own sets of problems. If you want to read this full report, I'll put the link on my website, which I'll give towards the end of the program. One thing interesting about this is seeing how, even like with Obamacare, during this time period when they've talked about great increases, there was supposed to be mental health parity, where insurance companies were supposed to treat mental health conditions the same as physical health conditions. That obviously, from a healthcare perspective, is not happening. But like the prior report that was talking about overall health, this really has a lot to do with social determinants of health rather than just simply the healthcare system. But we've got problems on both fronts. Okay, well, I've covered a lot of the big picture here on mental health, and I like to drill down a little bit and talk about what we can do as individuals with friends or loved ones who might be going through suicidal thoughts and such. This from the National Association of Mental Illness. My friend is suicidal. What should I do? Suicide isn't an easy topic to think about, let alone discuss, especially with someone you suspect is suicidal. But it's incredibly important that we do talk about it and get our loved ones the help they need to prevent them from reaching a point of crisis. Here's a little bit about what you can do to help them. Offer steadfast support. If your friend is experiencing suicidal ideation, that means they're hurting immensely, and they likely want to talk about it and feel heard. You can show your support by listening and giving them your empathy and compassion. After speaking with licensed psychologist Laura Chakas, she gave some insight on this. It is important to give lots of empathy to help them feel comfortable sharing and hold back from trying to fix what they're going through or giving them any advice. First, just really listen and show your concern by your body language and compassionate statements. A few examples of compassionate statements. I'm sorry you're going through this. It's important to validate what your friend is feeling and experiencing. In addition, this statement shows that you care for and empathize with them. Can I bring you dinner? What would you like if I came over? Instead of asking if there's anything you can do, think of a couple specific things that you could do to help or support your friend. You mean so much to me. I can't imagine life without you. Take a moment to let your friend know just how much you love and care for them. You might even remind them of a funny or heartwarming memory. Be sure to do so in a calm, non-aggressive way. I know that you're in pain. Again, validate how your friend is feeling and reiterate to them that you are there to help however you may be able to. A few examples of non-compassionate statements you should avoid saying. Your life isn't that bad. It might not seem like your friend has reason to feel so unhappy, but their pain is something nobody else can understand. Know that if you are having thoughts of suicide, they are in more pain than you realize. Avoid this statement as well as similar phrases, as they only pass judgment. You don't really want to die. You may say this out of fear, but stop yourself if you can. If your friend is talking about suicide or showing signs of suicidal behavior, it is to be taken seriously. Do what you can to make them feel comfortable opening up instead, and ask if they'll let you get them professional help. You have too much to live for. Everything will blow over. This statement also undermines their feelings. If your friend is suffering with suicidal thoughts or feelings, they don't feel like they have a lot to live for, even if you know they do. Everybody's got their problems. When someone is suicidal, they feel that they have no other option, and telling them this is incredibly invalidating to their pain. Ask questions. After listening to your friend, it's then time to take a more active role in the conversation. Sometimes an individual's suicidal ideation isn't obvious, but if you do have the slightest suspicion that your friend might be suicidal or is thinking about suicide, be direct and ask them about it. Here are a few questions you could ask. Do you think about hurting yourself? Do you think about dying? Do you think your friends and family would be better off without you? If they answer yes to any of these questions, then follow up with these questions. Do you have a plan? Do you have the means to carry out that plan? Asking these questions will allow you to better gauge the severity of the symptoms and help you decide which step you you need to take next. Know when it's time to act. If you're having this conversation with a friend, it's time to reach out to somebody. However, depending on whether your friend is actively suicidal, that is seriously considering suicide, has a plan or the means to carry out a plan, or experiencing suicidal ideation without any intention of acting on it, passively suicidal, you need to make sure they are getting the appropriate level of care. After a conversation with Dr. Saw, a licensed clinical social worker, he explained that it is a common myth that those who are suicidal don't seek help. But in fact, many people reach out in some way, and often that is to friends and family before a mental health professional. Remember, people who are suicidal are in pain, and they just want that pain to go away. Option 1, ensure they see a therapist. If your friend is depressed but not actively suicidal, you should encourage them to see a therapist if they aren't already. You can help by offering to research and make calls if they're not feeling up to it, to finding a therapist themselves. You should also check in regularly to see how they are and make sure their symptoms have not escalated towards crisis. Option 2, seek immediate help. If they convey that they are actively suicidal, you should get help immediately. If they have a therapist or psychiatrist, call them to ask if they have a crisis plan in place or what you should do. If they don't have a therapist, you should take them to the hospital for an evaluation. If you are a child or teenager, it is essential that you tell a trusted adult, parent, teacher, school counselor, doctor, church leader, family friend, etc., even if your friend tells you not to. As a last piece of advice, be sure to take care of yourself too. There's nothing easy about helping a friend who's in pain. Okay, well, next up, earlier in the show, talked about social determinants health and how we're investing so little in public health. But this shows how much on the other end that we're spending on healthcare. This first story from The Hill, Medicare premiums to jump in part due to pricey Alzheimer's drug. Seniors on Medicare will have to pay more than $20 per month extra in premiums next year, a large increase that officials in part attributed to possible coverage of a pricey and controversial new Alzheimer's drug. The Biden administration announced last Friday that the monthly premium for Medicare Part B, which covers services like doctor office visits, will increase from $21.60 a month to $21.60 a month from $148.50 in 2021 to $170.10 in 2022. Officials said that is one of the largest increases in recent years. About half of that increase is due to contingency planning to make sure the program has enough money to pay for an expensive new Alzheimer's drug if Medicare decides to cover it, an official at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said. That drug, called Aduhelm and made by the company Biogen, has drawn controversy both for its price at $56,000 per year and because the Food and Drug Administration approved it despite doubts from experts about its effectiveness. And remember, the $56,000 per year is just for the drug. That's not for administering it every month intravenously and all the follow-up care with scan and such. Holy moly. And then going big, so overall what people are paying for healthcare, this also from The Hill. Family health insurance costs top $22,000 per year. A Kaiser Family Foundation survey finds that the average annual cost for employer-provided healthcare for a family reached beyond $22,000 this year, part of a steady increase that appears largely unaffected by the coronavirus pandemic. The research documented a 4% rise in the average cost for a family plan, hitting $22,221. On average, employees spend almost $6,000 toward that cost, with employers covering the remainder of the premiums. The average annual cost for a single employee's plan also increased 4% to $7,739 in 2021. In the past decade, the average family health insurance cost has jumped 47%, higher than the 31% boost in wages and the 19% rise in inflation in that time frame. The average deductible for all insurance plans that employees have to pay before coverage has also climbed in the past decade from $991 a year to almost $1,700 a year.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, I want to switch gears here a bit, and since this last week was concluded the COP26 about trying to deal with global climate change as a planet, I want to do a couple stories on the environment here. So first up from The Guardian, luxury carbon consumption of top 1% threatens 1.5 Celsius degree global heating limit. The carbon dioxide emissions of the richest 1% of humanity are on track to be 30 times greater than what is compatible with keeping global heating below 1.5 degrees Celsius, new research warns, as scientists urge governments to constrain luxury carbon consumption of private jets, mega yachts, and space travel. In keeping with the Paris climate goals, every person on Earth needs to reduce their CO2 emissions to an average of 2.3 tons by 2030, about half the average of today. The richest 1%, which is a population smaller than Germany, are on track to be releasing 70 tons of CO2 per person per year if current consumption continues, according to the study. In total, they will account for 16% of total emissions by 2030, up from 13% of emissions of 1990. Meanwhile, the poorest 50% will be releasing an average of 1 ton of CO2 annual. In other words, the 1% are doing 70 tons per person a year compared to the 2.3 tons target, and the poorest half of the world are averaging 1 ton of CO2 annually, less than half of what the goal of 2.3 tons. Yikes. Okay, a teeny elite appear to have a free pass to pollute, said Nafkodi Dabi, climate policy lead at Oxfam, which commissioned the study by the Institute of European Policy Development and the Stockholm Environment Institute. Their oversized emissions are fueling extreme weather around the world and jeopardizing the international goal of limiting global heating. The paper shows that the fight to keep 1.5 degrees Celsius within reach is not being hampered by the consumption of most people on the planet, but by the excessive emissions of the world's richest citizens, said Tim Gore, author of the briefing. Even the total emissions produced by the richest 10% could be sufficient to exceed the amount allocated for keeping within the 1.5 degrees Celsius target by 2030, regardless of what the other 90% of the population does. Gore said, to close the emissions gap by 2030, it is necessary for governments to target measures at their richest, highest emitters. The climate and inequality crisis should be tackled together. That includes both measures to constrain luxury carbon consumption, like mega yachts, private jets, and space travel, and to curb climate-intensive investments like stock holdings and fossil fuel industries. Okay, and next up, since money and cost-effectiveness seems to be a big issue in people's minds, not a bad thing to look at, this from Science Daily. Cutting ammonia emissions is a cost-effective way to prevent air pollution deaths. Tackling pollution from the emissions of nitrogen compounds, particularly ammonia, could reduce many of the 23.3 million years of life that were lost prematurely across the world in 2013 due to nitrogen-related air pollution. An international study led by Chinese scientists have discovered using a modeling framework. Particulate matter 2.5 air pollution is the largest environmental risk factor for human health worldwide. Sulfur dioxide and nitrogen compounds such as nitrogen oxides derived from fossil fuel combustion in power plants, industrial furnaces, or boilers, as well as vehicle emissions and ammonia emissions mainly from agriculture and natural sources are important precursors of particulate matter 2.5 formation in the atmosphere. The study published in Science revealed via a cost-benefit analysis that ammonia mitigation is one of the most cost-effective ways to improve global air quality and public health. The study found that the ammonia contribution to PM2.5, the particulate matter 2.5, is larger than nitrogen compounds globally. and in most countries indicating that PM2.5 formation is more strongly limited by ammonia than by nitrogen compounds. Total years of life lost from PM2.5 pollution caused by nitrogen compound emission increased from 19.5 to 23.3 million globally between 1990 and 2013. The global average marginal cost of premature mortality caused by nitrogen compound emission in 2013 was 33% higher than 1990 due to the increasing emissions and higher willingness to invest in healthcare. Yeah, invest on the back end. That's a great idea. The study assessed costs and benefits of ammonia and nitrogen compound emission reductions and found the global average cost of reducing ammonia emission is over four times lower than the global health benefits, but the abatement cost of nitrogen compound emission is over two times higher than the global health benefits. This effectively means the marginal global cost of ammonia emission abatement is only 10% of nitrogen oxide emission abatement, meaning ammonia reduction is cheaper and more effective. Maybe we can start with that. Okay, well, the last article I want to report is from The Intercept, and this has to do with the chemical pollutants in our environment and the regulations or lack thereof and able to deal with it. EPA withheld reports of substantial risk posed by 1,240 chemicals. The Environmental Protection Agency has withheld information from the public since January 2019 about the dangers posed by more than 1,200 chemicals. By law, companies must give the EPA any evidence they possess that a chemical presents, quote, a substantial risk of injury to health or the environment. Until recently, the agency has been making these reports known as 8E reports for the section of the Toxic Substance Control Act that requires them available to the public. In 2017, for instance, the EPA posted 481 substantial risk reports from industry on ChemView, a searchable public database of chemical information maintained by the agency. And in 2018, it added another 569 of these 8E reports to the site. But since 2019, the EPA has only posted one of the reports to its public website. And I want to point out here that these 8E reports is information that just comes from the chemical companies. It's not independent surveillance or monitoring. This is just, we can't even get the low bar of chemical companies telling what they know about these chemicals. Okay, back to the story. During this time, chemical companies have continued to submit the critical studies to the agency, according to two EPA staff members with knowledge of the matter. Since January 2019, the EPA has received at least 1,240 reports documenting the risks of chemical serious harms, including eye corrosion, damage to the brain and nervous system, chronic toxicity to honeybees, and cancer in both people and animals. PFSA compounds are among the chemical subjects of these notifications. Not only has the agency kept all but one of these reports from the public, but has also made them difficult for EPA staff to access, according to the two agency scientists, who are choosing to remain anonymous because of concerns about possible retribution. The substantial risk reports have not been uploaded to the database used most often by risk assessors searching for information about chemicals, according to one of the EPA scientists, who has worked closely with the 8E statements. They have been entered only into an internal database that is difficult to access and search. As a result, little and perhaps none of the information about these serious risks to health and environment has been incorporated into the chemical assessments completed during this period. The fact that these studies aren't being included means that there's a very good chance there are some chemical assessments there that should have reached different conclusions, said another EPA staff member who is familiar with the chemical assessment process. The information comes in the wake of evidence of dysfunction and corruption in the EPA's Office of Pollution, Prevention, and Toxics that five whistleblowers have provided to The Intercept, the EPA Inspector General, and members of Congress since July. All five remain employed by the agency and are working with Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, an organization that represents whistleblowers. The 1976 Toxic Substance Control Act clearly intended for the EPA to act on the information sent in by industry, and according to an agency spokesperson, each 8E submission is promptly reviewed and evaluated to determine the degree of concern that should be attached to it, as well as recommendations for appropriate follow-up actions. But the two EPA staff members who spoke with The Intercept said that the reports do not trigger an immediate response. I would think most people in the public would assume that when we get these reports, we give them incredible scrutiny and say, oh no, what are we going to do about this? But basically, they are just looking into, just going into a black hole, said one of the two scientists. We don't look at them, we don't evaluate them, and we don't check to see if they change our understanding of the chemical. In its response to The Intercept, the EPA disputed the scientist's description of the process. Quote, "This is not a factual representation of how EPA deals with TSCA 8E submissions," the agency spokesperson wrote, going on to say that agency staff do review the submissions to determine, quote, "the degree of concern." For decades, companies routinely claimed that much of the information in an 8E report could be declared confidential business information, allowing them to strike the name of the chemical from the report and making it impossible to address the harm. In 2010, the Obama administration changed course, announcing that it would begin reviewing the confidentiality claims and, if they were not legitimate, publicly post the reports along with compounds' names. The chemical industry pushed back against the policy, arguing that forcing companies to reveal the names of their compounds was a violation of their intellectual property rights. And close observers of the industry believe that pressure from companies that held this view was likely what led to the Trump EPA to stop publicly posting their reports. It is not easy to keep selling your chemicals when people know they're likely causing cancer or other serious disease, says Eve Gartner, an attorney who manages the Toxic Exposure and Health Program at Earth Justice. It makes perfect sense that in an EPA that was largely controlled by industry, chemical manufacturers would lobby to get EPA to stop releasing significant risk studies, and EPA would agree to keep this basic health and safety information secret. Gartner said it's harder to understand why the Biden administration, which has repeatedly expressed its commitment to scientific integrity, has not already fixed the problem and made this backlogged health and safety information available to the public. As the scientists who spoke with The Intercept see it, part of the explanation may be budgeting constraints. The Biden EPA was left with a situation that puts public health at risk and is expensive to fix. The Trump administration created this huge backlog for them, and then it became just this intractable problem, said one of the EPA scientists, who added that several other staff members have expressed concern about this problem. In its response to The Intercept, the EPA spokesman said the agency is planning to address the problem. Quote, "The Biden-Harris administration has asked for significantly more resources for this program in the 2022 budget request to ensure we're meeting our obligations under the Toxic Substances and Chemical Act, most importantly protecting health, human health and the environment. In the future, as resources allow, EPA will continue to strive to make 8E reports public available in ChemView in the interest of increased transparency," end of quote. While the Trump EPA stopped posting the 8E reports, it was also putting more resources into accommodating the companies the agency regulates, fast-tracking the approval of chemicals they considered high priority, pressuring risk assessors to downplay or ignore the risk presented by chemicals, and creating digital tools to ease the regulatory experience. Together, it shows EPA cares more about industry and getting their products out than it does about protecting human health and environment, said Kyla Bennett, Director of Science Policy at Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Even before 2019, when the EPA was making their risk reports from industry publicly available, the agency did not always respond to the information in them with any urgency. In 2016, The Intercept reported on 16 of these 8E reports that DuPont submitted to the EPA between 2006 and 2013. The reports detailed the potential dangers of Gen X, a then-unknown PFAS compound that the company had introduced to replace another chemical in the same class, PFOA, which has been found to cause thyroid disease, cancers, and other health problems. The study showed that the replacement compound caused many of the same health problems in lab tests that the original chemical did, including cancer and reproductive problems. Although the studies were in the ChemView database, the EPA appeared to be unaware of them. The agency had made no public announcements about the information and had taken no actions to protect public health. As an agency employee said of the 8E reports to The Intercept at the time, a lot of them just get filed away. In 2019, The Intercept used the ChemView database to find 40 new PFAS compounds that had been the subject of 8E reports. Among the health effects listed in the animal studies, the company said the agency, were neurotoxicity, developmental toxicity, decreased conception, severe convulsions, bleeding in the lungs, tooth problems, postnatal loss, hair loss, depression of sperm function, abnormal development of skulls, ribs, and pelvises, and testicular, pancreatic, and kidney cancers. Despite the concerning reports, all 40 PFAS compounds were allowed onto the market and remain unregulated. Last week, more than 15 years after DuPont submitted the first of those reports, and more than 5 years after The Intercept first reported on them, the EPA took action on Gen X using the 8E reports. On October 25th, the agency released new toxicity assessments that found two closely related chemicals, both known as Gen X, to be very toxic.
The assessments were based largely on the information that DuPont sent to the EPA in 8E reports years earlier. They also included information from a letter Kim Orrs sent the EPA in an 8E report in March, which noted that approximately 80% of blood samples taken from workers at one of its plants outside of the U.S. had tested positive for one of the two Gen X compounds. This science-based final assessment marks a critical step in the process of establishing a national drinking water health advisory for Gen X chemicals and provides important information to our partners that can be used to protect communities where these chemicals are found, said Radhika Fox, EPA Assistant Administrator for Water, when announcing the finalized assessment. Yet in the years between the EPA's receipt of the information about Gen X's toxicity and the assessment, the chemical was released into the drinking water of more than 1 million people in North Carolina. As happened with PFOA and many of the new PFAS compounds introduced after Gen X, the chemical was allowed to contaminate the environment and harm countless people, all while the EPA sat on information about its dangers. In 2019, some of the EPA staff members who had been entering the 8E reports into the EPA's public database were reassigned to another project to help chemical companies track the progress of their products as they move through the approval process. The agency created an online tool that refers to internally as, quote, Pizza Tracker, which was launched later that year. According to a strategic plan of the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics, work on the Pizza Tracker is expected to continue through 2024. While acknowledging that it prioritizes the chemical tracking process and, quote, that resources used to sanitize and post 8E submissions to ChemView were reduced and eventually stopped, the EPA denied that funding was shifted especially from posting the 8E reports to funding the Pizza Tracker. Like the Domino's app, the chemical tracking tool is user-friendly, allowing companies to quickly and conveniently access information about their products as they move through the regulatory process. The two EPA scientists say that in order to protect the public health, risk assessors need to be able to see the industry's reports with the same ease. And they say taking resources away from protecting the public from health and environmental hazards while directing them towards the improvement of industry's experience of being regulated betrays misplaced priorities. The whole concept of Pizza Tracker is that you're delivering an order to a customer, said one of the EPA scientists, but the companies are not our clients. The public is. Okay, well, sorry on ending the reporting of today's episode on that decidedly not optimistic note. I do have a good article here in the bonus articles, of which I have 10 this week that you can read online, along with all the articles that I covered in this episode. So let's start with those 10, and I'll give you the link to go to afterwards. First up, 10 reasons for optimism on climate change. These are dark times, but hope is not lost nor foolish, and change has already begun. 2, Biden taps Califf to head FDA, an agency where he has plenty of unfinished business. 3, Rochelle Walensky said she'd fix the CDC, but 9 months in, she's faltering. 4, labs with no one to run them. Why public health workers are fleeing the field. 5. Broadband access, healthcare's newest challenge. And 6. If you want to know more about the upcoming surge, this COVID winter may cause fewer deaths yet still bring a surge. 7. What would the public health experts do? Stat asked 28 about their holiday plans amid COVID-19. So if you want some more insights about this winter, that's a good place to get it. 8. Understanding healthcare consumer preferences is key to effective COVID-19 vaccination messaging. If you're still trying to deal with people with vaccine hesitancy, might be one to look at. 9. The compounding impact of the COVID pandemic on Black women. And lastly, but not leastly, number 10, Red America's Compassion Fatigue, a report from Mobile, Alabama. There are people in Red America that actually value taking care of their neighbors, but they're getting tired, thus the compassion fatigue. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London, and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.